Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Erie News, and today is April 16th, 2024. It's Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. And our first story, like always, is out of Stranger Than Fiction stories, and it's titled The Cemetery of Fools. Venice is a district in northern Prague. It is home to a psychiatric hospital built at the beginning of the 20th century. The asylum was one of the largest in Europe. Small houses surround a large park with an Art Nouveau church. However, what attracts tourists and legend trippers is a cemetery that received the dead for 50 years. The 6-acre parcel of land is known as the Cemetery of Fools. Like many asylums built during these years, it had its own graveyard. Patients from the hospital were buried there from 1909 to 1951. Originally, it was used for the patients' children, but eventually the inmates were buried there as well. Over 4,300 people were interred on these grounds. Some were patients and others were not. Suicides who were refused last rites and burials by the Catholic Church were taken to Bonnie Cemetery. They were wrapped only in linen and dropped into the ground without a coffin. There were also unfortunate children born to parents who were hospitalized, as well as other tortured souls that suffered from schizophrenia, alcoholism, different addictions, and people you would not want to meet, like arsonists, pedophiles, and murderers. They were exiled in death to a burial plot in the southwest corner of the cemetery. After decades of disuse, the grounds became overgrown with only small hills, covered with ivy to signify where the tombs are located. Only a few have gravestones. There's a feeling of eternal winter, no matter what season it is. However, the worst feeling is felt in the area where the children are buried. Besides the patients, there are also World War I soldiers from Serbia, Bosnia, and Russia, nurses, and locals. In 1960, an asylum in Pergine, Valsugana, Italy, was converted into a military hospital. 600 inmates, mostly made up of soldiers, were taken to various hospitals in Austria-Hungary. 100 were brought to Bonice. That same year, a typhus epidemic swept through the asylum that took over 640 patients, one of them an Italian soldier. Eventually, 48 of the Italian patients were buried at Bonice Cemetery. In 1932, Benito Mussolini placed a marble plaque in the cemetery chapel with their names. Other sources point to patients who were all sane, but inconvenient in some way to their family and were brought to Bonice. Elderly heirs who lived too long, bastard children, and others thought to be best forgotten, lived out their days in the asylum and were laid to rest in the cemetery. There is only one memorial with a legible name, Maria Tuma Reiter, born in 1883 and passed in 1912, when she was 29 years old. Records indicate she died suddenly of pneumonia, but there is surety that she was a patient at the Bonique Psychiatric Hospital since she lived at the Bonique Colony, which are cottages where the workers tended their own vegetable garden close to the clinic. She was married to Antonin and had two children. For many years, her grave was tended, even though the rest of the cemetery was overgrown. It's believed her husband and later her children looked after it. However, by 1980, her children were dead and the grandchildren no longer lived in the area nor maintained the memorial. Though most of those buried at Bonice are anonymous, there are some who are notorious. Gavrilo Persnip, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the assassin of Archduke of Austria, Franz Ferdinand, and his wife is buried here. His actions in 1914 precipitated World War I. He was 19 when he committed the assassination, and because of his age, he was spared the death penalty and sentenced to 20 years. However, he died in April 1918 from tuberculosis. And let me correct this. He was buried here, but I believe they exhumed his body and took it and did a memorial for him, if I believe that's the correct description of that. But anyway, he was the only prisoner in the Tirinstadt fortress, or small fortress in Terezin, about 43 miles north of Prague. It was an old place established in 1784. 3 days after he died, prison guards were the only witnesses to the secret funeral. A gravedigger discloses information in May 1918. At the end of World War I, the body was exhumed and taken to Sarajevo. Sergeant Pavlicek. The alleged murderer of the prostitute Otila Vranska is said to be buried here. He never confessed to the crime, but confided to his friends he had done it. He ended up as a patient at Buni Psychiatric Hospital, where he killed himself. It wasn't until 2023 that the murderer of Otali was established. The murder of Otali Varanska, a street girl, is one of the best-known crimes in the history of the Czech criminology. She was born in Slovakia and came from a poor background. It all started when two pieces of luggage were found at two different railway stations. They were sent from Prague from different stations. The autopsy found the parts belonged to one woman, who was killed by two blows to her head, probably with a meat cleaver. Her head was cut right off while she was unconscious, and a knife was used to stab the headless body seven times. She had eaten an apple a couple of hours before her death. After the picture of the luggage and the woman's head were published in every newspaper, the two women identified her as their sister. The police learned her name and that she was a streetwalker. She was last seen in front of a restaurant around midnight. During the investigation, police received nearly 5,000 mostly anonymous letters that led nowhere. The last letter pointed a finger at someone. The last letter pointing a finger at someone was received in 1966, 33 years after the crime, even though the case closed in the 1940s. It was thought that Varanska might have also been the victim of a serial killer, since there were seven women killed from 1926 to 1938. All of them were prostitutes except for two, and five of them came from Slovakia. Most were strangled, and three were beheaded. Caustic acid was used to make identification difficult. All of the cases remained unsolved, and it's never been confirmed if they were the victims of one person. Perhaps the reason the murder remained unsolved for so long was errors found in the first autopsy. The medical examiner based the time of death to very early in the morning of September 1st, 1933, based on undigested apple in her stomach. He also described where the body was dismembered by someone who had good knowledge of human anatomy. Police naturally looked at doctors or medical students as likely suspects. Despite information provided by witnesses as to who the real culprit was, according to Marie Nemikova, one of Varanska's sisters, she had been promised marriage and a job by a Sergeant Major Joseph Pekny of the Kasarna military barracks. They had met in the spring of that year. Another witness described that Varanska met Pekny and another prostitute named Kokoslova, who was his current mistress, on the night she died. Pekny was divorced, and the night he had promised the victim marriage when he was questioned by police. Could the threat of a scandal over a reneged marriage offer been the motive to kill Varanska? The Czech police didn't see the contradiction when Pekny and Kokoslova provided alibis for each other. They also didn't search his apartment, despite the fact that Varanska's body had been washed post-mortem, which meant the perpetrator enjoyed some type of privacy in order to do this. Another misdirection in the case concerned letters sent to the editorial office of a Slovakian daily newspaper. They were stamped Phantom of the Street and signed by Karel Widowary or Karel XY. He admitted killing Varanska by accident on Perlova Street. They had gone to his apartment, but once she brought up the subject of money, he realized she was a prostitute. He described where he was hurt by a prostitute in the past, which is when he drugged Varanska, stunned her, and then cut up her body, using a picture of a human skeleton to guide him to quarter the corpse. Then he transported the suitcases to the different train stations. The only reason the police took notice of the letters was that initial reports of the crime did not reflect that the victim was a prostitute. The Phantom also admitted he killed another prostitute named Janotova and that he planned to continue murdering women since this gave him pleasure and he longed for blood. He described himself as a wealthy man who had traveled extensively. He said he spoke English and worked for several years in the French Foreign Legion. In one of the letters, he mentioned that he was tired of living and wanted to commit suicide. The authorities estimated he was about 40 years with more than a basic education. He was so brazen that he actually dropped off letters directly at the newsroom, but the man was never caught. Despite the contents of the letters, police believed he was not the killer, because he mostly described details appearing in the newspaper. In 2017, a hair sample of an unknown person found during the autopsy on the victim's hand and arm were used for DNA comparison with samples from family of the original suspects. The results came back in 2020, but were kept private until 2023. It was announced that after studying documents from the original investigation, it was concluded with 80% certainty that Sergeant Joseph Pekny killed Otilia Waronska. Whether Antonina Kokoslova was present during the crime is unknown, but it's believed she was an accomplice. Pekny was a professional soldier, and a relationship with a streetwalker would mean the end of his career in the military. It's believed that Waronska, upon meeting Antony Kokoslova, realized the promise of marriage would never be kept and went to Pekny's home to confront him or to blackmail him. Pekny's daughter refused to cooperate and provide a DNA sample. This is recently, of course. However, it became a moot point when it was found the hair on the body belonged to a woman which was neither Waronska or Kokoslova's, and they used Kokoslova's grandson's DNA as a comparison. The autopsy report reflected that Waronska had died from blood loss from the cut on her neck, which was made by someone standing behind or over her after tilting her head forward very skillfully. This indicates a perpetrator with experience or training in this type of act. Afterwards, she was laying on the ground where she was struck twice in the head, which could have been done with an axe or a military saber. The wound to the chest was shallow and done after she was dead. Most telling was that the incisions to remove the head from the body caused vertebral injuries, which indicated this was not someone with professional knowledge of anatomy. Significant force was needed, indicating it was not done by a woman. Pekny was originally one of three suspects. However, as a veteran, the investigators were reluctant to question him thoroughly. The final theory is that Waronska could not return to her apartment because of her landlady's midnight curfew, and she went to Pekny's flat. An argument ensued, and a loud dispute at that time of night would have been noticed. Perhaps this is when he decided he had to get rid of her. Where Waronska was buried is unknown. Not even a hint of where the grave was at has been discovered. Eventually, the Waronska family died out. Pekny died at the age of 80 and had three children. Current law enforcement... Current law enforcement refuses to give out their whereabouts. The place where Waronska was killed no longer exists, and no pictures were taken. When Bonnie Cemetery closed in the early 60s, most would not come near it even during the day. But what discouraged most enticed others, like Satanists, who started to use the abandoned chapel. Behind the derelict church was a morgue and an underground passageway, where dark rituals were performed despite crackdowns by the police during the 1980s. In 1989, the chapel was burned down. Eventually, the graveyard was used as a dump site. Then in 2013, Jiri Vitek, a local fireman, decided to reclaim and clean up the grounds. With the help of friends and volunteers, they removed 40 tons of debris, including charred beams, from the chapel. In 1996, Baroness Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of UK, paid an unannounced visit to the cemetery. The reason given was that she came to exhume and return the remains of a British pilot shot down during World War II to his homeland. After two unsuccessful digs, since most of the graves were unnamed, they resorted to speaking to a local petty thief and vagrant known as Tattooed Pepik. His one-time drinking companion was the cemetery manager, which had told him who was buried and where. In exchange for a bottle of rum, he pointed them to the right spot, and after digging, they found a coffin. Inside the remains had a ring or some other type of decoration that confirmed they had the right person. Rumors were this was not an unknown soldier, but a family member of Sir Dennis Thatcher, who had been taken prisoner of war during World War II. Whoever he was, the remains were taken back to England. Czech-born film director Milos Forman used the cemetery's overcast appearance in the burial scene of his 1984 film Amadeus, where Mozart's body was dumped into a mass grave. The film was nominated for 53 awards and received 40, including 8 Academy Awards for Best Picture. Mozart himself had mysterious circumstances surrounding his burial. As depicted in the film, he was buried as a pauper in a mass grave at St. Mark's Cemetery outside the old city walls of Vienna. His funeral took place on December 7, 1791, under stormy skies, which kept away many from attending his rites, including his wife. There's another version where he was given a third-class funeral, which would have given him his own individual grave. In a time where records were poorly kept and knowledge was only as good as a person's memory while they were alive, the grave digger from 1791 died a few years later and took the location of Mozart's burial place with him. A memorial was erected in 1855 in a place chosen more by conjecture than from actual fact. Another unanswered question pertaining to Mozart's death was whether he was poisoned or not. Within a week after his death, a Berlin newspaper claimed he met his end by foul means. He was a young man who only a few weeks before was in good health. He fell ill after a public performance in Vienna and died 2 weeks later. The blame was laid at the feet of Antonio Salieri, who was known to be Mozart's bitter rival. A play was created titled Mozart and Salieri. Later, it became an opera, revolving around the themes of envy and poisoning. In the film, Salieri tricks Mozart into composing the Requiem music using his troubled past with his father. However, the one who commissioned the Requiem Mass was Count Franz Walsegg-Stupak, for his young wife who had died. Later in life, Salieri suffered a nervous breakdown from the suspicions that he poisoned Mozart. He was admitted to the Vienna General Hospital, where he accused himself of doing the deed, but then recanted. By then, he was an old man with a terminal illness and deranged. This version of Mozart's death little by little became more of a fact than just a suspicion. Mozart's symptoms have been examined, but without an autopsy, no definitive answer has been found as to what killed him, if it wasn't poison. The only illness that is posited as being responsible for his demise was epidemic streptococcal infection. Another question, which is a subject of conjecture, is whether Mozart composed a Requiem in D minor on his deathbed. In the film, he dictates the music to Salieri, who takes down the composition without fully understanding the genius of the music. This is partly believed to be accurate when friends of Mozart describe where hours before his death he had the score of the Requiem brought to his bed. He sang the alto while the others sung the soprano line. It is said he dictated sections of the music to his pupil Franz Süssmayr, the man Mozart's widow Constanze appointed to complete the score. There's dispute as to whether this is true, but some did remember Süssmayr's receiving the dictation from Mozart while Salieri watched. Considering all the mysteries that surround the last days of Mozart's life, it is most appropriate the movie setting for his burial was placed in such a bizarre and offbeat location as Boni Cemetery. So in other words, of the many, a few thousand that were buried here, like they said, most were anonymous. You know, they were patients or even people that were outcast from being buried in the regular cemeteries, but the majority of them were unknown. And the few that are known, though, they did have some significant history as to who they had been, or in this case, what they had done. The next story, also out of Stranger Than Fiction stories, is titled Harvey the Serial Killer. Perhaps older, but just as lethal, an 83-year-old convicted serial killer was indicted in 2022 for the murder of a woman whose dismembered body was found in a shopping cart at a Brooklyn street corner. On March 7, 2022, at Jamaica Avenue near Vermont Street, a passerby saw a very unusual thing inside a discarded tire. It was a severed human leg. A few days before, another gruesome discovery was made by another unfortunate passerby who came to investigate what was inside a black plastic bag inside a shopping cart. It was a human torso minus a head, arms, and legs. Harvey Marceline, who goes by the name of Marceline Harvey, a transsexual, was caught on surveillance video disposing of the human remains. A search warrant was issued, and upon further investigation, the victim's head was found in his apartment along with electric saws he bought at a nearby Home Depot. Susan Layden, 68, formerly of Teaneck, New Jersey, is the victim whose body parts were found discarded in black bags on the streets of Brooklyn. On March 2nd, a missing persons report was issued for Layden, who lived in Stonewall House, an LGBTQ senior center on St. Edward Street and Fort Greene. On February 27th, a surveillance camera filmed Layden entering Marceline's apartment located in a newly opened affordable housing development. Susan was carrying a multicolored bag with a flower decal. Layden was never seen alive again. 3 days later, Marceline was filmed leaving the building with the same bag. He rolled it to the corner of Pennsylvania and Atlantic Avenues and threw it in the trash. Layden's torso was found stuffed into a bag resembling the multicolored one brought to Marceline's apartment. Marceline had a very troubling and dangerous history. In 1962, Marceline had voluntarily admitted himself to Bellevue and was discharged into the custody of his wife, Florence Jackson, who he had married in 1961. He was found not to be psychotic. On April 18, 1963, Jacqueline Denise Bonds, 21, was murdered by Marceline inside a Harlem apartment on 8th Street. Several eyewitnesses testified that Marceline shot Bonds in the public hallway of the apartment. After shooting her once, Marceline followed her into a bedroom and shot her once more with a .32 caliber revolver. She ran to the living room, but there was no escape from her murderer, and she died there with 3 bullets in her body. Prior to this, Marceline had already exhibited his violent temper towards women. On April 5, 1963, a grand jury in Brooklyn indicted him on charges of attempted first-degree rape, second-degree assault, and second-degree burglary committed against Clementine Bennyfield. These crimes were committed on March 14, 1963. Marceline claimed he had been with Jacqueline Bonds at the time of the alleged crime. She was subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury to provide an alibi for him on the day of her murder. She didn't appear nor testify before the grand jury, which would have been a motive to kill her. During the trial, Marceline was examined by 3 Bellevue psychiatrists, and they concluded that he was without psychosis, although he was possessed of a schizoid personality with sociopathic features, but he was competent to stand trial. Marceline was paroled in 1984. So basically, this gentleman killed his would-be alibi person. Anyway, let's keep going. The decision to set Marceline free on a society proved to be deadly for another woman who was killed by Marceline less than a year after his release. Ana Laura Cerrera Miranda died after being repeatedly stabbed. Her murderer was sentenced to a prison term of 6 to 12 years following a manslaughter conviction in the first degree. In a similar MO to his 2022 crime, he stuffed the victim's body in a bag and dumped it on the sidewalk by Central Park. At a state parole board in 1997, Marceline said that he had problems with women. He was released in 2019. On March 30, 2022, Marceline was charged with first and second degree murder, tampering with physical evidence and concealment of a human corpse in the death of Layden. The victim reportedly struggled with addiction and mental illness in recent years. The two met in Tompkins Square Park in the East Village. Marceline referred to Layden as one of his coven of women. Marceline said he has 2 sides, Harvey and Marceline. He said women friends provoke him into violence. I'll tell them, there's a side of me you don't want to see, but they don't listen. Layden's head and limbs, along with blood, cleaning supplies, a hammer, and box for an electrical saw, were found in Marceline's apartment, according to the prosecutors. Layden was one of 3 people who would occasionally sleep over at Marceline's East New York apartment. Marceline told police one of the other 2 were responsible for the murder due to jealousy. So, this gentleman, he's very violent towards women, and he kind of says that he has kind of a split personality. But in this last murder, he accuses one of the other 2 women, I guess, that he entertained as the ones that not only killed, but dismembered Layden. It just so happens, coincidentally, the same way he had disposed of a prior victim. Incredible. Okay. All right. Let's see. And now, during his previous prison terms, Marceline acted as his own lawyer in a number of lawsuits. He complained that all female parole boards were sexist when they denied his release in 1997. Okay, so this is another thing. Even the parole board, which were all women, have a problem with him. But it makes you think, who really has a problem with who? But anyway, Harvey Marceline was born in 1938. His father died when he was 10, and his mother worked as a seamstress. They were born in Harlem, but later moved to Washington Heights. Court records indicate that Marceline was referred for a psychiatric examination in 1952 when he was 14 by Catholic Charities due to incidents of truancy, theft, heterosexual and homosexual activity, and cross-dressing. In 1957, Marceline started committing burglaries as documented in court records. Now, this is a very interesting story also, this following part of it. Monica Archer was a caseworker at George Daly House in Alphabet City, where Harvey Marceline lived. She started in September 2019, and everything was fine until she spoke out about how Harvey often acted in an erratic and dangerous manner. Despite warnings, Harvey Marceline was allowed to have his own apartment, and within a week, he murdered Susan Layden. For her troubles, Archer was fired, and in December 2022, she filed a complaint with the Manhattan Supreme Court. She described where Marceline made constant threats to kill her and other staff members and kept a gun at the shelter despite being on parole for life. She started to take the alternate routes home after work when Marceline tried to follow her home a few times. Her supervisors were made aware of the situation and allowed the felon to keep living there. Archer continued to raise the alarm and filed a complaint against the facility with the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the suit says. Her supervisors retaliated by putting her on janitorial duty and refusing to let her work remotely. According to the suit, she was suspended without pay on May 24th and 1 week later was fired for insubordination, although they had no documentation, written or otherwise. The facility's parent company, the New York Foundation for Senior Citizens, received at least $95 million in city funding since 2009 for support services, transportation costs, and at least $5 million from the state since 2008. After the crime, Harvey Marceline was charged with Layden's murder and has pled not guilty. He now claims that he's transitioned to a lesbian named Marceline Harvey, who is a personality that controls Harvey Marceline. Marceline is slated to go to trial for the 2022 murder in the spring of 2024. This gentleman has been giving off signs since, what, 14 at the very least, that he's disturbed and dangerous. It's not just disturbed and dangerous. He's gone to prison twice. And I don't know if they were thinking that when they let him go in 2019, because he was elderly in his 80s, that like all this was behind him. And it cost Layden, became a victim, another victim. And let's see what happens now with this whole scenario, because his other two covenant women or whatever they were, they're lucky they got out of there with all limbs attached. Anyway, let's go on to the next story. This is out of Mental Floss, and it's titled The Legend of London's Time Traveling Tomb. Deep in London's historic Brompton Cemetery sits a mausoleum that houses a Victorian heiress, her daughters, and a time travel story that keeps growing. Swinging open the front gate of Brompton Cemetery is a bit like cracking the spine of a book detailing London history. Famous suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst rests there. Beatrix Potter strolled its 39 acres and plucked names from tombstones to use in her work, including decedents Peter Rabbit and Mr. Nutkins. More than 35,000 monuments in all are present, rich and poor, known and obscure. In the middle of the grounds, enshrouded by trees, stands a mausoleum. An imposing 20 feet tall with a pyramid peak, it's made from granite, with a heavy bronze door secured by a keyhole. Decorative accents line the front, furthering the air of mystery. The door's marked and displays a rectangular band of Egyptian hieroglyphs. Erected in the early 1850s, it was intended as a final resting place of a woman named Hannah Courtois and two of her three daughters, Mary and Elizabeth. Courtois' tomb would be remarkable for its imposing stature and cryptic veneer alone. It's the largest, most elaborate construction in Brompton, but there's more to the story. For the many visitors who make moonlight visits to the cemetery, and for a small band of London raconteurs, the tomb's missing key and resulting lack of access has led to speculation that something strange is going on inside, that it's secretly a time machine. It's a fantastic notion, but one that London musician and Courtois historian Stephen Coates is quick to dismiss. It's not a time machine, he said. It's a teleportation chamber. Oops. In order to try and digest the bizarre urban legend that's been constructed around Courtois' tomb, It helps to understand the highly controversial life of the woman who ordered its construction. Born around 1784, Hannah Peters fled an abusive father at a young age and found work as a housekeeper and as a tavern employee. In 1800, a friend introduced her to John Cordoy, a 70-year-old former wig maker in poor health who had made a fortune in the lending business. Peters was shortly in his employ as a housekeeper. Within the year, she had given birth to the first of three daughters. She claimed they were Cordoy's, although some eyes were raised in suspicion that the friend who made the introduction, Francis Grosso, might have been the real father. Cordoy's illness is also ill-defined in historical accounts, although it was said to follow a violent run-in with a prostitute in 1795 that left Cordoy, who had been slashed at with a knife, reserved and antisocial. He apparently warmed to Peters, who took his name and exerted considerable influence over many of his decisions. Cordoy's 1810 will, which left the bulk of his fortune to an ex-wife named Mary Ann Woolley and their five children, was revised in 1814, so Hannah received the majority share. When Cordoy died in 1818, the contents of the will were disputed both by Woolley and Cordoy's French relatives. They argued that dementia had overtaken Cordoy's better senses. The legal arguments dragged on through 1827, at which point Hannah and her daughters had received most of Cordoy's money. According to the account presented in author David Godson's 2014 book, Cordoy's Complaint, largely based on diaries kept by Cordoy housekeeper Maureen Sayers, Hannah's urge to distract herself from the often unpleasant Cordoy led to developing a friendship that would prove essential to her later mythology. Like many Victorians of the era, Hannah was intrigued by Egyptian iconography, particularly hieroglyphics. She believed Egyptians had a deep understanding of astrology and their place in the universe, and she invited Egyptologist Joseph Bonomi over for regular visits. Bonomi and Hannah would spend hours dissecting Egyptian lore, with Hannah hoping to one day fund Bonomi's expedition to Egypt so he could study their work. The two would also arrange for a 175-foot-tall monument dedicated to the Duke of Wellington to be constructed, and insisted that the sculpture resemble an Egyptian obelisk. When Hannah died in 1849, her remains were said to be placed in the expensive, elaborate mausoleum in Brompton that paid tribute to her interest. Bonomi arranged for the tomb to feature Egyptian characters and a pyramidal top. Later, Mary and Elizabeth, who shied from marriage because they didn't want men chasing after their wealth, joined her. Susanna, who married, was buried elsewhere. When Bonomi died in 1878, he arranged for depiction of Cordoy's tomb to appear on his own modest headstone. Whether Bonomi intended it or not, an illustration of Anubis, the Egyptian god of the dead, appears to be looking in the direction of his friend's final resting place. Things appeared to remain status quo at Brompton for the next 100 years or so. Then around 1980, the key to the tomb was lost following a visit by Hannah's relatives. And that's when things took a turn for the weird. Press reporter Helen Smith wrote a story in October 1998 that may have been the first mainstream article to raise the theory that Cordoy's tomb might actually be a time machine. Smith described the monument as a strange, imposing structure containing three spinsters about whom almost nothing is known, and cited an unheralded author named Howard Webster as a perpetuator of the story. Webster claimed his research had excavated a connection between Bonomi and Samuel Alfred Warner, a maverick Victorian genius and fraudster said to have attempted to interest the British armed forces in several advanced weapons, too advanced, in fact, to actually exist. Webster speculated that Warner's inventive abilities may have led him to consort with Bonomi, who supposedly had knowledge of the Egyptian theories of time travel. Together, the two convinced the wealthy, trusting Hannah to finance her secret project, with Bonomi providing ancient wisdom and Warner adding his breakthrough scientific resources. By placing the device in a cemetery, Warner could guarantee the structure was unlikely to be disturbed over decades or centuries, allowing him to return to London after traveling through time again and again. The lack of a key was crucial to Webster's tale, since it had been lost and no one had been inside for years. It could be argued that perhaps Warner was busying himself in a manner similar to an occupant of the TARDIS, bouncing from era to era, while Hannah and her family were either entombed or buried someplace else entirely. Webster also claimed that plans for the tomb were missing, which was rarely the case with other monuments in Brompton. The story bubbled to the surface periodically over the years. In 2003, an album cover by musician Drew Mulholland depicted the tomb and its eerie structure, which led to some renewed interest. In 2011, Coates, a musician with a band named The Real Tuesday Weld, came across mention of the theory and was intrigued. He wrote a post on his blog positing that the Cordoy tomb was not a means of time travel, but that Warner had the technology to teleport torpedoes, and that he later adopted that framework to develop a series of teleportation chambers in and around the Magnificent Seven, a group of London's historic private cemeteries. It was a way to move around the city, Coates says. Warner and Bonomi worked together on ancient Egyptian occult theory and science. I posted that on my blog, and it started to take on a life of its own. Coates' premise is a proper study in how an urban legend can proliferate. With a key still missing, it was impossible to disprove the teleportation idea with any real precision, and the mythology allowed for a great deal of speculation. Was Warner, who died in 1848, killed because he knew too much about revolutionary technology? Why did the tomb take 4 years to complete following Hannah's death, which meant she didn't actually enter it until 1853? Was Hannah duped by the Tudor Fund, what she might have believed would be a pioneering mode of travel? It became, Coates says, one of the myths of the city. In 2015, The Independent ran a feature describing his belief, contrasting it with the activities of Hannah Cordoy descendant Ray Godson, who simply wanted access to the tomb to pay his respects to his great-great-grandmother. The feature came just as Coates was busy organizing visitor groups that could come, with the cemetery's permission, hear the legend of Cordoy, Bonomi, and Warner while standing near the tomb in the middle of the night. I fell in love with the idea. Vanessa Wolfe, a professional storyteller based in London who hosts the gatherings, tells the magazine. I must credit Stephen Coates. I contacted him after hearing about the myth and told him I really wanted to tell the story. He said to go for it. Wolfe hosted the first event in 2015 and has done several more since. The first time we were absolutely overwhelmed with bookings, she said. In the story presentation, Wolfe tells of a barking mad inventor named Warner, who connects with Bonomi and hatches an idea for teleportation network. Hannah, she relates, had an interest in the occult and unexplained phenomena. There's a huge interest in the story in London, she says. I think people are just interested in the fabric of places where they live. This is a story rooted in the secret, in the occult, but no one is quite sure what actually happened. It can be difficult to corner Coates for a precise answer on whether he believes his fanciful hypothesis about the resting place of Hannah Cordoy. When initially contacted for an interview, he agreed while mentioning that he came up with a whole teleportation system idea as a background to a short story. In conversation, he presents the teleportation springboard as a way for people to make up their own mind about what the tomb might contain. A breath or two later, he expresses doubt that Hannah's daughters might still be entombed there before wondering whether the mausoleum might be home to a secret subterranean chamber. It's all alternative theory based on historical fact. He says it's hard not to imagine a slight expression of amusement across his face. Performance art or not, the attention has increased awareness over the cemetery's attempts to secure funds for a site-wide renovation. Cordoy's tomb was partially spruced up in 2009 following aging, frost-coated chunks of granite sloughing off the side, with costs partially covered by a family trust. When asked to comment on whether the midnight vigils and sightseers have been disruptive, Brompton officials refer questions right back to Coates, who appears to have become their unofficial spokesman on all things involved molecular disruption and Egyptian time-hopping. It's not something they promote themselves, Coates says. They're very welcoming of people who come if they're showing respect. The conservation efforts have been going on for years, and the events help that. At the last Coates Arranged show, tickets went from £6 to £8, with a quarter of the proceeds donated to the cemetery's rebuilding efforts. How many people will visit once a key is made is another question. Both Coates and Brompton Cemetery historian named Arthur Tate say that efforts are currently underway to fabricate a placement that would allow Hannah relatives access to the tomb. After an initial flush of curiosity, wouldn't the presumably ordinary interior dampen interest? Maybe it may not be established it's not a time machine, Coates hedges. It may just deepen the mystery. For Wolf, who still has regular engagements hosting visitors near the tomb, seeing a key may be a letdown. It's much nicer, in a way, not having it, she says. It's really all in the minds of the audience. It's a slab of rock. The real magic is in their minds. Usually, while Wolf normally gets very positive notices from those attending her performance, one reviewer on Instagram does stick out. It said something like, "Oh, I was really excited, but then got really disappointed. She didn't even open it." So there you go. Okay. I don't know. That would be strange. It's not a time machine. It's a teleportation. All right. Okay. All right. Next story out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories is titled The Ghosts of an Ancient City. Let's see. The Mellow House sits abandoned somewhere on Goa, approximately 100 miles south of Bombay. The dark folklore surrounding the house stems from a dispute that supposedly led to murder between family members. At the end of the 15th century, Vasco da Gama discovered the maritime route to Asia via the Cape of Good Hope. In a dozen years, Portugal possessed Mangalore, Cochin, Ceylon, Ormuz, Diu, Goa, and Negapatam. Europeans were spurred to find a route to the Orient due to the Ottoman Empire blocking their route on the Silk Road to Asia via Turkey. They taxed anyone wanting to cross at exceptionally high amounts. The search for the sea route also resulted in the discovery of the Americas by Western Europeans. In 1510, Portuguese conquered their ruling sultan and set up Veja Goa, or Old Goa. Portugal ruled the settlement for the next 4.5 centuries, and the enclave became known as Portuguese India. After 1585, it was decided to establish shipyards so vessels could be made in Goa, using the teak wood available in the area. The shipyard went through several names: Ribeira, Ribeira das Armas, Ribeira das Naus, Ribeira Grande, and finally Arsenal de Marina Exercito. This is Portuguese, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. It was this shipyard which allowed the Portuguese to dominate expansion in Asia, despite its shortage of manpower. There were fleets of ships funded by the Portuguese royal court that were dispatched yearly from Portugal to Goa. Known as the India Run, it was the main carrier of the spice trade between Europe and Asia during the 16th century. The carrack Cinco Chagas and the galleon Bom Jesus and Madre de Deus used during the Dutch-Portuguese War were made at this shipyard. The ships would dock at Ribeira de Gales, but it wasn't only ships that were here, but there were living quarters for officials and a prison for convicts brought on board the ships. There were several important buildings such as Casa de Moeda, which is the Royal Mint, Atilaria, Gun Foundry, Casa de Pólvora, the Gunpowder Factory, Alfandega, the Customs House, and the Manacal, where cargo was stored, the Peso, where cargo was weighed, and finally the Elephant Stables. The private chapel of the Ribeira Grande was dedicated to the Cinco Chagas, or Five Wounds, and in a corner of the Ribeira on the eastern side was located the Church of Santos Martires, or Holy Martyrs. In 1878, José Nicolau da Fonseca made the following observation on the state of the Ribeira Grande. Quote, "There is nothing at present to show that once flourishing conditions of these places, instead of the bustle that once prevailed here, a complete silence now reigns, broken only by the wind whistling through the branches of the palm trees, which grow luxuriant on the spot." The De Mello family history stretches back into the 16th century and was always well connected to the Portuguese court. In 1864, there was a mention made that Don George de Mello was the aide-de-camp to the Governor General of Goa, and by 1870, he was Governor General of Portuguese India himself. However, there were other de Mello involved in the history of Goa. In 1632, the Mughal army attacked the Portuguese garrison at Fort Hooghly. There's mention made that during the siege, which lasted over 3 months, a de Mello, a Portuguese half-caste, betrayed the fort by providing a way for the enemy to enter the fort. So it's not clear whether part of the de Mello family spawned the dark stories concerning the derelict house in Goa. The urban myth describes where two brothers were given ownership over the same property, However, it seemed bitter feelings developed. The situation ended tragically when one brother killed the other, and then the second brother died soon after, some say by his own hand. The house was then said to be haunted by the tormented souls of the brothers, and the family members which took possession of the property were visited by a curse. Maria de Lourdes Bravo da Costas Rodriguez, a librarian and reporter, wrote an article in 2015 concerning stories published about the DeMello house. She described being familiar with the DeMello family, and the stories lack substantiation. She says there is no DeMello house in Santemol, however, there is one in Raya, which was left empty after the family moved away. As an abandoned property, it was vandalized, but there was no history of fratricide. The ancient town of Old Goa sits at the mouth of the Mandovi River. In 1516, the population in Old Goa was about 200,000 when cholera of a virulent type broke out and spread so fast over the city that persons of every age, rank, and sex were daily swept away in great numbers. Even poultry and livestock died. The bell tolled so much to signal the death that Martim Afonso de Souza, the governor, forbade the tolling of the bell for any funeral. In 1570, the city was attacked by Ali Adi Shah with an army of 100,000 men and 2,140 elephants. There were only 700 European soldiers, 300 friars and clergymen, and the local populace. They were under siege for 10 months, but the attackers finally left after their numbers were reduced by sickness and fighting. Food became scarce and there was famine, followed by an epidemic fever of a virulent character. It was determined that it wasn't only an attack, but the location of the city, since it was surrounded by stagnant pools and marshes. There was no hygiene for public health, and the water supply of the city was very bad, especially in the hot season. The streets were also not kept clean. At one point, the body of a dead elephant was thrown into a lake near the Church of Trinidad. In 1635, another epidemic fever broke out, spreading desolation, and devastation all around. As the city suffered the scourge of the epidemic, in 1639 the Dutch blockaded Goa harbor with 12 ships. They subsequently left, perhaps fearing contagion. In 1687, the capital was moved away from Old Goa, leaving behind many Baroque ruins, more than 100 churches, monasteries, and royal courts designed in Renaissance architecture. The buildings were used as a quarry for the new capital, taking what many believe was its curse to the new city. In 1859, what was known as the Chorao epidemic claimed 1,000 men, women, and children in Chorao, an island on the Mandovi River. Thousands fled the island and was deserted for almost 100 years. Even if the haunting of the DeMello house is more urban myth than reality, there is so much history in this ancient city that could account for strange occurrences. There are the thousands that died from plagues. In Margao, the oldest city in Gao, there is a hill adjoining the town which allows a view of the town and also of the sea and surrounding villages. It was crowned by a chapel dedicated to Nossa Senhora de Piedad, or Our Lady of Mercy, which was regarded by the locals as their special patroness. The chapel was originally constructed by the Jesuits and dedicated to the Holy Cross, with a view, as stated by their chronicler, of, quote, delivering the place from the annoyances of the evil spirits by which it was then haunted, end quote. The chapel was rebuilt in 1820. In 1565, a church dedicated to St. Paul was erected by the Jesuits on the ruins of a main pagoda, and the idol of Damodar was removed to Zambalan. The church was burned by the Muslims and was rebuilt in 1585. It decayed and was reconstructed in 1645. One of its altars was dedicated to St. Roche, who interceded for the village, which was in the throes of an epidemic that lasted from 1772 to 1776. Under the chief altar, there is said to be a slab of black stone covering the grave of a native child killed with the Jesuits at Kunkulin. The Kunkulin massacre involved the mutilation of priests and civilians by Hindu chieftains in the Goa village of Kunkulin on July 15, 1583. 5 Jesuits, 1 Portuguese civilian, and 14 Goan Catholics were killed. Besides the many that died through disease or misadventure, there are forgotten cemeteries where perhaps the spirits do not lie quietly in their graves. There was the fortress of Cabo, built a few years after 1540 on the western end of Goa. By 1878, all that was left were ruins and 3 cisterns. At the beginning of the 18th century, the Portuguese allowed the British to erect the hospital, barracks, and other buildings, which were demolished in 1848. The only thing left was a cemetery with 38 tombs, only six bearing epitaphs. The Inquisition came to Goa in 1500, and the officials were housed in an existing three-story palace made of black stone. It was in the great square close to the cathedral and known as the Palace of the Inquisition. It was initially staffed by three Dominicans. However, by 1682, the number had increased to 32, and ultimately, there would be a staff of 48. There was a chamber in the palace known as the Mesa del Santo Oficio, which was decorated with green taffeta curtains. There was a huge crucifix propped against the tapestry that almost touched the ceiling. According to stories told by the inhabitants of Goa, every individual charged with witchcraft or any offense against the Catholic religion was placed before the crucifix when all of a sudden a thrill appeared to pass through the person's frame. They would tremble from head to foot and drop senseless on the ground, incapable of fixing their eyes on it anymore. On a raised dais were the inquisitors and other officers. The place had other rooms and a great number of prison cells. In 1774, the Inquisition was disbanded and restored in 1779 and abolished in 1812. The derelict building was pulled down in 1820. The religious orders were expulsed in 1835, and their properties were appropriated by the government. There are many places long forgotten that could make a shiver run up your spine, when a coolness in the air is the only sign that one who is no longer of this world walks with you. So in other words, whether this house, this DeMello house, which is supposed to, you know, be haunted or whatever, because of these brothers, it really doesn't matter because, and if you go by that librarian, that she's a native of Goa, says that, you know, the story is more really an urban myth. God knows that there's enough thing. I mean, people die, obviously, but apparently maybe because of this lack of hygiene or because they were located so close to a swamp, they were, it seemed to go through periods of really, really bad epidemics, things of that nature. So God knows there's plenty to go around as far as possible, you know, ghostly things going on there. And from what I understand, there's still many, many old buildings that are left standing. This other story, also out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, is titled, Is This Amelia? Amelia Earhart disappeared July 2, 1937, on the last leg of a transworld flight. 2 years after her disappearance, Earhart and her navigator declared dead. For all this time, her fate has remained a mystery. Every few years, someone claims to have found Amelia or her plane, but definitive proof has never been provided. In 1938, a lighthouse on Howland Island was named for the aviatrix. This was the place where she was supposed to refuel before ending her travels after leaving Ley, New Guinea. However, even though her radio transmission was heard by those on the island, she and her navigator, Fred Noonan, never arrived. The message heard was, "We must be on you but cannot see you, but gas is running low. Have been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at 1,000 feet. Claimed by the United States in 1856, the island was used for guano harvesting. However, the 450-acre island has never been permanently settled. A small colony named Itasca Towns was started in 1935 with a few persons who cleared the land for an airstrip. They lived in a half dozen small wood-framed structures and tents near the beach on the island's western side. The island was heavily bombed the day after Pearl Harbor. Richard Dickey Kanani Whaley and Joseph Kealoha Kele Ihana, wow, this Hawaiian name, Kele Ihananui were killed. The two other settlers were rescued in January 1942. Considered mostly as a navigational hazard by sailors, the island was abandoned since 1942. Present day, the Earhart Light is a day beacon, and the atoll is a wildlife refuge, including the reef off its shore. So what are the theories of what happened to Amelia Earhart that prevented her from landing on Howland Island? In 2018, Richard Jantz, an emeritus anthropology professor at the University of Tennessee, claimed 13 bones, including a skull found in April 1940 on Gardner Island, now Nikumaroro, belonged to Amelia. along with the bones were remnants of a pair of shoes and a box that once contained a sextant. It had been theorized the meteor crashed on the atoll and died a castaway. The high tides would have washed the wreckage of the Lockheed Electra out to sea. Gardner Island had been uninhabited since the turn of the century. A forensic examination by Dr. David Hoodless, principal of the Central Medical School in Fiji, of the remains in 1941 concluded they belonged to a stocky, middle-aged man. Dr. Hoodless suggested the remains belonged to an individual of European mixed-race heritage. The bones, which have been since lost, showed they were very weathered when discovered. Other doctors besides Hoodless who examined the bones believed they were older than 4 years. The man was estimated to measure about 5 feet 5 inches in height. Earhart measured 5 feet 7 inches, and her navigator was 6 feet tall. The remains were shipped to Suva or Fiji via the RCS Nimanoa. On board, they were examined by Dr. Lindsay Isaacs, acting senior medical officer in charge of medical and forensic investigation throughout the whole country. Throughout the whole colony. This is in 1941. Isaac examined the material and identified the remains as belonging to an elderly male of Polynesian race, and adding, the bones have been in a sheltered position for upwards of 20 years and possibly much longer. Isaac also noted that some of the bones crumbled during transport. In 1929, the SS Norwich City wrecked on the shores of Gardner Island. They left Hawaii bound for Vancouver, but encountered a storm as they came to the equator. They got lost and ran aground, forcing the crew to abandon ship. 11 men died by either drowning, being dashed by the heavy seas against the coral reef, or eaten by sharks. The survivors were rescued a few days later. In 1998, a private group reevaluated and discredited the earlier report issued in 1941. They used cranial analysis software, or FORDISC, to suggest the skeleton was potentially a Northern European woman, which would make the bones possibly what was left of Amelia Earhart. However, without the actual bones, it would be impossible to give a definitive answer. And other physicians backed up the findings from 1941. Another theory is that Earhart and Noonan flew to the Marshall Islands, which were controlled by the Japanese. Speculation was the Japanese believed they were spies and imprisoned or executed the pair. In 2017, a picture was unearthed in the National Archives by retired federal agent Les Kinney. The picture is of a group of people at a wharf on Jaluit Atoll in the Marshall Islands. The photograph is stamped with the Office of Naval Intelligence, or ONI, and was credited to a U.S. spy. In it, a Caucasian male with a woman alongside him with a similar hairstyle and physique to Amelia are in the background facing away from the camera. A barge with an airplane on the back is seen being towed by a ship. The theory that Earhart and Noonan were captured by the Japanese at the Marshall Islands has been around since the 1960s. Based on stories from Marshall Islanders who said they saw the plane land and the pair taken into custody by the Japanese. Japanese authorities stated they had no records of Earhart's capture. However, many of their records did not survive World War II. Others speculate Earhart and Noonan both survived and returned to the United States under assumed names. Author Joe Klass wrote in his book Amelia Earhart Lives in 1970 that Earhart became Irene Craigmile and then Irene Bolam when she married Guy Bolam. Mrs. Bolam denied the claim and filed a $1.5 million lawsuit. The book publisher withdrew the book soon after its release, and the parties reached a settlement out of court. Bolam's life history was researched, including her 1933 license as a private pilot, and events in her life, in her personal life, excluded her from being Earhart. Joe Klaus was not the only one who believed that Earhart didn't die out in the Pacific and instead made it back to the mainland. In 2003, retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Roland C. Reineck released his book titled Amelia Earhart Survived. He speculated, that the search for Earhart gave the United States an excuse to complete reconnaissance of the Japanese, and Earhart and Noonan returned and continued life with assumed names. Dick Spink, a retired teacher, took Reineck's theory and continued research, claiming Earhart landed on Mealy Atoll. Others believe the plane ran out of fuel before reaching the Marshall Islands and crashed into the ocean. The mystery and the lure connected to Amelia Earhart is as powerful as ever. In March 2022, a leather cap that Amelia Earhart wore on a transatlantic flight in 1928 went up for auction. It was expected to sell for $85,000, but instead brought in $825,000. Anthony Twiggs, 67, had tried for years to prove that he had inherited the item from his mother. Earhart wore it in the 1929 Women's National Air Derby and lost it in the crowd waiting for her in Cleveland. Twiggs' mother, Ellie, was part of the crowd, and she told her family that a boy who liked her found the helmet on the ground and gave it to her. A. Earhart was handwritten on the inside of the cap. In 2021, using photo matching technology, Twiggs was able to authenticate the headpiece. The last expedition to find Amelia dates to March 2024. Deep Sea Vision used an unmanned submersible to scan the ocean floor near Howland Island. Like others before them, the theory is that after miscalculating their location, Earhart and Noonan ditched the airplane into the Pacific Ocean. In the fall of 2023, they scanned what appears to be the image of a plane. The plans are to return to the location in 2025 with hopes of reading the plane's radio registration, NR16020, which is written on its wings. If this is indeed Earhart's plane, the logistics would have to be planned in order to bring it to the surface. Only time will tell if Amelia and her navigator had been resting in a watery grave all these years. There's a lot of theories out there about what happened to her. I personally had never heard about the one that they were fine, that they came back to the United States and just changed their name. And for some reason, I guess that they were told, hey, the U.S. needs to spy on the Japanese and that's why you're going to do it. I don't know. But I'd never heard that story before. So anyway, I will be back with you soon with some more weird and eerie news. Believe me, there's always, every day there's more and more of it. Some more weird than others. But until next time, take care.